Good evening and welcome behind the news for October 9, 2003. This is Doug Henwin. We're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got a theme tonight, terrorism, the war on terrorism specifically, and is the United States focusing on the wrong targets? We've got two authors of new books to address this topic. One, the Italian journalist Loretta Napoleoni, who is the author of Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. She, however, had a piece that was supposed to be in Vanity Fair, and you'll hear the story when the interview begins, but it's not going to be in Vanity Fair. It will be in Z magazine, most of what she will have to talk about is about Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, one of America's great allies, and Loretta Napoleoni will talk about the ideological and financial support that Saudi Arabia has given to al-Qaeda. And then at the bottom of the hour, the French philosophe, I think he is identified as, with no small degree of irony, Bernard-Henri Lévy, who was the author of a new book called Who Killed Daniel Pearl, which is about the Wall Street Journal reporter who was murdered in Pakistan, and Levy, who is regarded by most people in the United States as some kind of right-winger. We'll be talking about his investigations into the murder of Pearl, but he's certainly no wind-up neocon, as you'll find out in the interview. And a couple of announcements before I'll look at the recent economic news headlines. First of all, I will be part of an extravaganza tonight. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Tom Frank, who is the editor, along with Dave Mulcahy, of a book called Boob Jubilee, a collection of articles from the Baffler magazine, a journal published out of Chicago. Tom Frank, Dave Mulcahy, and several of the contributors to the volume will be appearing tonight at Book Court in Brooklyn. That's a bookstore in 163 Court Street in Brooklyn at 7 p.m. I'll be there. Tom Frank, Dave Mulcahy will be talking. I've even got my French purple shirt on to mark the occasion. And a couple of other contributors. So that's tonight, Book Court, 7 p.m., 163 Court Street in Brooklyn. And then a rival event that I should announce only because, I appear in it. This radio show appears in it. Tracy Kwan, the author of the book The Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, and one of the characters in that book actually appears on this show. And I'm unfortunately described as asking an earnest question. I hope I'm not too earnest, but anyway, it's always nice to be a character in a novel. And Tracy Kwan will be reading from this novel at the Museum of Sex, which is at 233 Fifth Avenue, the corner of 27th Street, this evening. It's not free. It's an $8 admission, but that's, again, tonight. That's also at 7 p.m. Tracy Kwan reading from Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl. I doubt she'll be reading the portion about this radio show, but if you pick up a copy, you can read all about it. I don't remember the page numbers, but it's not too hard to find. Anyway, that's the Museum of Sex, 233 Fifth Avenue, which is the corner of 27th Street. Tracy Kwan at 7 p.m. And I'll announce all that at the end of the show again, in case you missed some of that. A couple of items in the news. First of all, Arnie. Gosh, you know, it's kind of scary, isn't it? The guy with a friend of mine put it, all the people of California worried about economic ruin and uncontrolled immigration, and suddenly a guy with an Austrian accent makes everything seem very clear. And that's just why it's kind of scary. Although it's being presented as a popular eruption, the turnout was only about 53% of eligible voters, and that's only slightly higher than the record 51% turnout. That was a record low for California governor races, which was set last November. So even though Arnie won a fairly convincing victory, the turnout was nowhere near what a lot of people were predicting. And, of course, now Arnie has some serious problems on his hands. Most serious of all is balancing California's budget. He was rather scarce of the details on how he planned to do that. Last year, Gray Davis, the outgoing governor, faced a $38 billion shortfall, which he closed through a mixture of spending cuts, creative accounting and about $11 billion in borrowing. And there is now an $8 billion shortfall in the budget this year. Schwarzenegger has promised to repeal the increase in the car tax, which occurred recently. That will increase the budget deficit by another $4 billion. So Ernie has to come up with $12 billion out of a budget of around $100 billion. And he's also said he's not going to cut education, which is some 20% of the budget. It's going to result in savage cuts if he sticks to his no new taxes pledge. It's going to result in savage cuts in other services, and it's pretty much impossible to do. So he's got his hands full, he certainly doesn't seem to have any idea about what to do. So he'll be relying pretty heavily on the former governor Pete Wilson's circle, but it's going to be quite controversial once the thrill of having the Terminator as governor wears off and the people of California discover that reality is still just as intractable as it was a few days ago. And it just doesn't work like it does in the movies. And now turning to the more economic news. First of all, the employment situation in Germany reported this morning. The unemployment rate in Germany dropped by a tenth of a percentage point, which is actually a positive surprise. Things are turning out a little better. Although the evidence is mixed, it does seem like the European economies are recovering slowly, even more so the Japanese economy, which is continuing to surprise a lot of analysts by doing better than anyone expects. This is being greeted with skepticism by a lot of Anglo-American commentators who, of course, think that Japan, in order to recover effectively, has to become more like the United States and Great Britain, with deregulated financial markets, so big low-wage economy, just a little a heavy dose of laissez-faire is what Japan needs. Even though Japan got rich by violating those precepts, the Anglo-American pundit class thinks that what Japan needs to do to recover is to be more like us. So there's a lot of skepticism that the Japanese economy is going to recover in any sustainable way. So we shall see, but it has been surprising people by doing better than anyone's expecting in recent months. Turning now to the U.S. economy, which is also doing a little bit better than people have been expecting. One of those regular private surveys that Wall Street types follow very carefully, the Institute for Supply Management, which is essentially a poll of purchasing managers, the people who buy things for corporations, who are very much in touch with the state of business, not only at their own firms, but to their customers as well. So it's a pretty good real-time measure of how the economy is doing. The ISM, the Institute for Supply Management, has been polling manufacturing companies for 40 or 50 years, but only in the last 4 or 5, they've been also polling service companies. So we don't know how well this index does. The manufacturing one does quite well, but the service one doesn't have that long a track record. But it was reported last week that it picked up smartly, still 63% of the firms are reporting expansion. Whenever the index is above 50, that's a pointer to an expanding service economy. So at 63, it's well above that level. And so off a little bit from recent highs, but still up quite a bit from the early part of this year. So the service sector does seem to be picking up. One not-so-nice spot in that report, they have a employment component in that survey, and it was slightly above 50 in August and fell slightly below 50 for September, which means that employment at service industries is not expanding. But it's also not contracting very much either. So it looks like the U.S. labor market is stabilizing, if not about to recover in any dramatic way. And confirming that, this morning's release of monthly unemployment, weekly unemployment claims, that is the people making their first visits to unemployment offices after losing their jobs to sign up for unemployment insurance benefits, a very timely and sensitive indicator of what's happening with the economy. And with the labor market in particular, that fell by 23,000 and is now well below the 400,000 level that is considered the kind of dividing line between weakness and not so weakness. So it's not certainly not going like gangbusters, but it is showing signs of gradual improvement and well down from peaks seen of several months ago. So a modestly optimistic sign here, but it's going to take many more weeks before we can say that the job market is really turning around. It's still pretty weak, and although, again, not as weak as it was a few months ago. And another weekly index we follow here, ABC News and Money Magazine do a survey of consumers every week to see what their mood is like and what their finances are like. That is really stuck at a fairly low level, and it fell another point for this week at minus 20. And so it's really been quite flat in this region. It's not disastrously negative, but it's certainly not the kind of thing we'd want to be seeing if the economy were really seriously recovering. So it remains where it's been really since June, bouncing around between minus 18 and minus 20, and now it's at the lower end of that range. And people are reporting that the state of their personal finances is not so good, but slightly better than it was 3-4 weeks ago, but still not so great. And people's evaluation of the national economy also quite weak, and that's actually lower than it was a few months ago. So not a pretty picture there. And that's it for the economic news. In a phrase, the U.S. economy does seem to be stabilizing, but is not going like gangbusters, and which is usually what it does when it starts recovering. Historically, the economy after a recession does recover with a very dramatic bounce, and that's just not happening this time. Okay, so turning to the interviews. Let's take a little musical break, and then we'll talk about the interviews. A snippet from today's musical selection, Fisher Spooner's international smash mega hit, Emerge, as rethought, repurposed, remixed by Paul Van Dyke. And now, Loretta Napoleoni is an Italian journalist, and she has just published a book with Pluto called Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks, a very comprehensive analysis of the economics of who supports terrorist groups around the world, and it's not just Al-Qaeda, it's many, many other terror groups around the world. But she also wrote a piece about Saudi Arabia and its relation to jihadism. And, it was going to be appear in Vanity Fair, but then the editor decided not. But most of what I talk about in this interview with her is about that article. So, let's listen to Loretta Napoleoni, and she will tell the story of her relations with Vanity Fair and such, and then also the story of Saudi Arabia. This was recorded a couple of weeks ago. Loretta Napoleoni. First of all, you have a little publishing tale. You had a piece about Saudi Arabia that was going to be in Vanity Fair, but now it's not. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was approached by the political editor of Vanity Fair in London in the spring, and he asked me, because he read my book, he asked me if I wanted to write an article for Vanity Fair on Saudi financing, focusing on the banks. So I agreed to do that, and I wrote the article, and it was approved by the political editor, and it was supposed to come out in Vanity Fair in the December issue, which comes out at the beginning of November. And then at the 11th hour, they decided not to publish the article because they judged it, you know, too strong for the readers. So they gave me my rights back, and they did pay for the article anyway, So I gave it to Zinet, and it's coming in the November edition of Zinet.
Oh, well, tell us something about that article. Saudi Arabia is, in your story, at the heart of the financing of terrorism, and the United States is not terribly interested in following up on those leads. So first of all, trace a little bit of the evolution of how Saudi Arabia became what it is, and particularly the doctrine of Wahhabism.
Saudi Arabia was unified at the beginning of the 1930s by the House of Saud. The House of Saud was a tribe which was very powerful in the Arabian Peninsula. The unification of Saudi Arabia was achieved thanks to the alliance that the House of Saud established with the religious clerics, the Wahhabis. The Wahhabis is an extremely radical, fundamentalist cleric organization which wants to go back to the purity and the origins of Islam. However, they want to go back to what was the concept of Islam of Wahhab, who was a cleric that lived in the 18th century in the Arabian Peninsula. He thought that the reason why the Islamic culture was in a decadence was because of the domination of the Ottoman Empire, and he decided to fight against the Ottoman Empire by organizing sort of insurgency religious groups who would fight against the existing regime and who would go back to the purity of Islam, which is, you know, to have the Arab Peninsula and the Islamic nations only to the Islamists.
But Saudi Arabia also has to make a lot of compromises from that purity, and that they have a close alliance with the United States and with oil companies who deal in mammon and not purity. How do they reconcile these contradictions?
Well, they don't. That's why, you know, the characteristic of the Saudis is ambiguity. On one hand, the royal family is courting the U.S. and is maintaining very strong ties with all the U.S. administration, including, of course, you know, the Bush administration. On the other hand, to please and appease the clerics, it's promoting Wahhabism all over the Muslim world, not only inside Saudi Arabia, but, you know, all over the Muslim world.
Well, no, was it 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11th were Saudi. Bin Laden himself is a Saudi. And there have been reports in our press that Saudis were very active in financing the operation. But I don't think anyone has really written about this in as much detail as you have. So could you tell us what precisely is the connection of the Saudis' elite to al-Qaeda?
The connections are very different levels. What I discovered through my analysis is that, you know, the real backers, financial backers of al-Qaeda are, you know, a group of middle class coming from Saudi Arabia. These are bankers, traders, merchants who actually want to bring about a regime change in Saudi Arabia, and they're using the Islamics to achieve this regime change. I looked particularly at the banks, the Islamic banks. Nobody really has analyzed it in detail. There are very important names. There is Bin Malfous, who is actually Bin Laden's brother-in-law, who was the head of the Saudi Commercial Bank, which is a bank where the royal family banks, actually. And Bin Malfous has been bankrolling several Islamic charities, which were used as fronts in Southeast Asia, for bankrolling Islamic groups. In particular, there was one group who was very active in the Philippines, and the guy who was in charge of the distribution of the funds in the Philippines was Kalita, who actually is another of Bin Laden's brothers-in-law. I also looked at the relationship between other Islamic banks, in particular the Al Baraka. The Al Baraka is actually the bank which owns part of the Al Shamil Islamic Bank. The Al Shamil Islamic Bank was one of the banks used by Bin Laden to distribute funds across the Muslim world to his various groups.
Presumably, the American authorities know this, or at least some of it. What
happened to an investigation. I mean, we had this, the war on terror is supposed to be the centerpiece of the Bush administration's policies, and they attacked Afghanistan. They didn't go after Saudi Arabia. First of all, what do you think of this approach of making war in Afghanistan and then Iraq, and why is the Bush administration emphasizing that and trying to even suppress any reference to Saudi Arabia?
I personally think that it was a mistake to go to war in Afghanistan, and also even more to go to war to Iraq. Let me tell you something that actually is quite interesting about why we went to war in Afghanistan. In November 2001, the Islamic parties of Pakistan actually offered to the United States to extradite bin Laden to Pakistan. Now, bin Laden had agreed to that, and also Mullah Omar had agreed to this decision. And the idea was that bin Laden would stand trial in Pakistan. The U.S. Rejected the proposal, and the reason that they gave was that they rejected on the off chance that they would actually capture bin Laden, which was going to look very good to the coalition forces. I mean, this is something that actually has been reported in the media over the last 2 years, but also this is something that has been confirmed by a former minister of the Blair cabinet, Michael Mitcher, who is the environmental minister, who resigned in protest of the Iraqi war. At the beginning of September, he wrote an editorial article in The Guardian. In this article, he mentioned this particular situation to back his theory that the Bush administration went to war because it was the casus belli that was needed, as in the situation of Pearl Harbor, to implement his policy of world domination in the Middle East. And to back this argument, he actually quotes a document which was produced in September 2000, which is called Rebuilding American Defense, where this policy of world domination is outlined.
Why do you suppose this protection of Saudi Arabia, why is the Bush administration so interested in keeping the Saudi name out of things?
The Bush administration is engaging itself in a very dangerous relationship with Saudi Arabia, not only for oil. I mean, oil plays a very important role, of course, because Saudi Arabia has been a key ally of the U.S. Let's not forget that during the Gulf War, Saudi Arabia released several million barrels of oil on top of its quota to maintain the price of oil stable. So oil does play an important role, but also the other element that we are taking into consideration is the role that Saudi Arabia has played in the Middle East since 1978, since the Iranian Revolution, which is a role of containment of the expansionary move of the Islamic Republic of Iran, but also is a role of contrasting Iran in every single possible way. And one of these ways was the export and the promotion of Wahhabism, which is an interpretation of Islam that is in sharp contrast with the Shia vision of Islam of Iran.
But we have this administration that almost everything that Bush does is organized around a response to September 11th now. That's all they could talk about. But it's just stunning to believe that, in many ways, the financiers and instigators of the attack have been given a free pass. What are they trying to preserve now at this point? Why? What are they afraid of something happening in Saudi Arabia that would be beyond their control?
Oh, I think the situation now is much worse than it was before. I think initially the protection that was given to the Saudis by the Bush administration, let's not forget that on the 13th of September, when 2001, where there was no flying in the U.S., a charter was organized where the Bin Laden family and the leading members of Saudi Arabia were actually put on and whisked away to Saudi Arabia. So clearly there was a desire to protect the Saudis after what happened. But I think that one of the problems that we're facing today is the fact that the Bush administration is undervaluing also the danger and the threat that comes from Saudi Arabia. I mean, we probably do not have enough information about what is the real role of people inside the royal family also in the relationship with Al-Qaeda. There was an interesting document which was provided by the Bosnian police. It's called the Golden Chain Link, and this was found during one of the raids in an Al-Qaeda safe house in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And this document had the list of the top 20 financiers of Al-Qaeda. They were all from Saudi Arabia, and there were very important names in that list. I mean, Bin Malhous and Salem Kamel, who actually is the brother-in-law of the king, and is the head of the Al Baraka Investment Bank. There was the brother of Prince Turki, who used to be, you know, the head of security in Saudi Arabia. Now, this document is still confidential in the U.S. The U.S. administration has refused to publish the list of the people, but the Bosnian authority have actually publicized the list.
What about the Pakistani connection? How does Pakistan and its ISI intelligence services fit in?
The Pakistani connection goes back to the anti-Soviet jihad. Basically, the U.S. in the 1980s, the Saudis managed to finance the Mujahideen using the ISI, which is the secret service in Pakistan. What happened after the end of the anti-Soviet jihad was the ISI continued its role of funding Islamic insurgency, you know, around Central Asia. The idea was to push Islamic insurgency at the periphery of the former Soviet Union. So we see, for example, the Central Asian republics, but also the Caucasus. Now, the U.S. and the CIA in particular knew that the ISI was doing this kind of financing of terrorism, and they didn't stop them at all. On the contrary, they actually, you know, backed them to a certain extent. Why did they do that? I personally think they did it because they again undervalued the danger of this kind of policy. After the fall of the Soviet Union, they thought that to a certain extent they were invincible, and also they were not so interested in that area anymore.
And is there any connection with these characters to the war in Chechnya?
Yes, there is a connection. The Khattab, who actually now has been reported as dead, but nobody knows for sure. He was an Arab Afghan, somebody who actually fought during the anti-Soviet jihad. He was a very close man to Osama bin Laden. Khattab was actually sent to Chechnya in order to train the Mujahideen and start the Islamic insurgency. At the same time, Saudi Arabia sent a few top clerics to act as recruiters among the population. Now, let's not forget that Chechnya was actually a secular country. There was, although the majority of the people were Muslim, it was not an Islamic country. The Muslims were not practicing their religion. It was actually a secular society. And through the 1990s, that country has become an Islamic hotbed. And this is thanks to the indoctrination that was carried out by the Islamist terrorist group and the financing of the Saudis.
A historical note, in the article and also in your book, BCCI pops up, an old favorite of connoisseurs of this sort of thing. How do they figure in the story?
Well, BCCI is quite interesting, the connection, because, you know, Bin Malhous, for example, who I mentioned before, Osama Bin Laden's brother-in-law, he was actually one of the shareholders of BCCI. And then when you go and look at the composition of BCCI capital, you discover that the majority of the capital came from Saudi Arabia. I mean, although the bank was a Pakistani registered bank and it was an international bank, the money actually came from the Saudis. Now, BCCI played a very important role during the anti-Soviet jihad, because it was the bank that basically channeled most of the money from either Saudi Arabia or the CIA to the ISI. And then when BCCI collapsed, the Saudis decided to set up their own system of banks, Islamic banks, and they used very much the model of BCCI.
Yeah, a lot of the coverage of this implies that the financing for Al-Qaeda and similar kinds of groups, is done through very informal banking networks. But in your version, it's much more institutionalized and sophisticated than that, right?
It's very sophisticated. I think we know very little about that system, and I also think that they know much more about our system than we think, you know, that they know. I'll give you an example of how sophisticated it is. I mean, Islamic banks, they levy the zakat on every single transaction that takes place. Now, the zakat is the religious almsgiving that every single Muslim has to give every year, and it is based upon the personal wealth, and it's equivalent to 2.5%. Islamic banks have incorporated this concept into the structure of the banks. So in Saudi Arabia, for example, what's happening is that, you know, the Islamic bank will levy the zakat and then will channel these funds to a department of zakat, which is part of the Ministry of Finance. And then from there, the Ministry of Finance allocates the fund at its own discretion to the 241 charities. Actually, now there are 235 because the Saudi have actually closed six out of, you know, 241. But that gives you the idea of how much the actual financing of the, you know, charitable organization is incorporated inside the banking system. Now, the yearly zakat in Saudi Arabia is between $10 and $15 billion. Now, that doesn't mean that all of this money go to fund terrorists. There are lots of charities who actually are doing very good work. But it would be interesting to find out, you know, what these charities are. You know, be interested to find out also, you know, where this money were allocated by the Department of Zakat. Now, all of this information has never been volunteered, you know, by the Saudis, and the U.S. has not even asked them.
The Bush administration seems to want to fight its war on terror using cruise missiles and Guantanamo Bay prison. What would you think would be a better way of going about it?
Oh, I think there are better ways to go about it. It's first of all never to have used war, because, you know, war plays in the hands of the Islamic groups. And, you know, we've seen it in Chechnya, for example. You know, they breed in states where there is a strong process of destabilization. This is exactly what is happening today in Iraq, and we're seeing that. A much better way would have been actually to follow the money, to look for the sources of financing, to understand also why these sources of financing are backing Islamic insurgency. I mean, to go to the root of the problem before, you know, starting bombing innocent people in Iraq.
So it would be police work rather than the 101st Airborne.
I think it's not only police work, it's also investigative work from, you know, the intelligence. Now, I would like to know why the CIA has not been able to infiltrate Al-Qaeda, for example. I mean, they managed to infiltrate the KGB, they managed to infiltrate the Eastern European Secret Services. Why, you know, has not infiltrated Al-Qaeda? Personally, I think they have not even tried until recently. I mean, they have ignored this phenomenon for over a decade. And of course, it takes a very long time to infiltrate an organization like Al-Qaeda. But also, we have not done any investigation into the financing of these people. And everything started 2 years ago. Very little has been done. Closing few charities is not going to solve the problem. The other thing I want to say is that the few investigations that have been conducted before 9/11, they actually encountered roadblocks from the Clinton administration and real serious blockages from the Bush administration.
So it's a bipartisan indifference.
Yes, I think, you know, it's very much the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, about they didn't want to upset the Saudis. I think nobody really could envisage, because their knowledge was very limited, what was going to happen. They never thought that 9/11 could ever take place.
And that was Loretta Napoleoni, an interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago, and she is the author of Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks, and also the article forthcoming in Z about Saudi Arabia and its relation to Al-Qaeda, its ideological and financial relations. And the Modern Jihad book has just been published by Pluto Press. And we'll back in a moment with Bernard-Henri Lévy after this additional word from Fisher Spooner through Paul Van Dyke. Fisher Spooner and their international mega smash hit, Emerge. And now, an interview recorded also a couple of weeks ago with Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is the author of a book called Who Killed Daniel Pearl, published by Melville House Publishing. And I've taken a little heat in the last couple of days, actually, from people who think I shouldn't be featuring interviews with a neoconservative like Bernard-Henri Lévy. People call him a charlatan and a phony and a poseur and all kinds of unpleasant names. And he certainly is quite a showman, and I didn't get to meet him. I only did this by phone. I hear he has quite extravagant hair. But his argument in this book is, I think, interesting and important, and what he has to say in this interview is, I think, interesting and important, focusing on the role of Pakistan, who is supposedly U.S. ally in the so-called War on Terror, but actually is really a hotbed of such terror. And so let's listen to Bernard-Henri Lévy, author of Who Killed Daniel Pearl. And Daniel Pearl, by the way, is the Wall Street Journal reporter who was killed by people who kidnapped him. And Pearl, even though I think a lot of people might hear the words Wall Street Journal and think he's a bad guy, he's actually a very fine reporter who wrote some very good stories for the journal. So it was both a personal and a professional tragedy that he died. And here is Bernard-Henri Lévy, interview recorded a couple of weeks ago.
Let me start by asking about the form of the book. It's a mix of journalistic style investigation and also some speculations about what Danny Pearl saw in his final days and what he was thinking and how it felt. And so it's kind of a mix of fact and fiction. And to an American reader, this is an unusual form. So I'm just trying to wonder what you're trying to accomplish with this approach.
No, first, it is not a mix because the difference is very precisely indicated all the time. The reader knows always where he is, if he is in the fiction or if he is in the investigation. I draw the line very precisely. Second point, the American reader is not so unfamiliar of this. Look at Norman Mailer, look at Truman Capote, my true masters in this way of writing. They go much further than I do in this alternative of fiction and in investigation. And third point, it is true that there were a few scenes, actually two in the book, which are imagination. I thought I had to do that for very... I could not hope to conduct until the end this empathy with Danny Pearl, with this empathy, without trying to put myself in his head. This is the purpose of the book, to go in his steps, to see the people he saw, to go in the places where he went, and to try to feel as he felt. And this is the reason why there is this scene in the book.
All right, this is a news show. Let me get to the news value of the book. Your thesis is that Pearl was on the trail of investigating links between Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani government. Tell the audience a little bit about how you came to this conclusion.
I came to that conclusion because, again, I put myself on the steps, on the trail, of Danny Pearl himself. I tried to rebuild, to reconstitute his last days, minute by minute, hour by hour. And I tried, that's why my real purpose, I tried to continue his own work. I tried to pick up the thread which he dropped on the road. And picking up the thread, I discovered that he was a great journalist, working on very sensitive topics, and one of these topics was the links between ISI and Al-Qaeda. This is the point on which he was working. And so I bring in many proofs of that in the book. And if I had Ned, there would be another evidence, a supplementary evidence, which is the very personality of his murderer, of Omar Sheikh, who is at the same time a man linked to Al-Qaeda and linked to ISI. The man who plots, who masters the kidnapping, is an agent both of Al-Qaeda and of ISI.
And why, if this is true, do you think the U.S. government has been so indifferent to this connection? Pakistan is still described as our ally in the war on terror.
This you should have to ask. You should ask it to Mr. Bush. This is, for me, an incredible situation. Absurd. Mr. Bush told us since months and months that the problem was in Iraq, that the mass destruction weapons were in Iraq, that Al-Qaeda was in Iraq, where it was not. And all that was actually in Pakistan. And now Mr. Musharraf is received as an ally, as a friend, by this administration. And it is a complete scandal. It is a complete absurdity. There is a real problem now in the diplomacy of America, in the definition by of what is a rogue state and what it is not. I could say the same, by the way, about the French diplomacy, because we also consider Musharraf as an ally. But well, America is the strongest country in the world, and it is really concerning a lot to know that they consider this group of murderers, this sect of assassins, as respectable people, which they are not. They are the killers of Daniel Pearl. It is a country where you have the biggest density of jihadists. It is a country where you have scientists of high level who dream to trade their knowledge to Al-Qaeda. This is Pakistan. And we have today in New York Mr. Musharraf bragging and going around and so on and playing as a good guy of the Anti-Terrorist Alliance. This is an absurdity. Our sons will look at us in a very surprised way when they will think of that situation.
Where do you think jihadism comes from? I think you describe it at one point in the book as a kind of bastard offspring of European culture and Islam. Could you describe that a little bit more? Some people treat this as kind of primal evil that's almost beyond explanation, but I'm sure that's not an
explanation. It doesn't mean anything to say primal evil is not an explanation. It's just stupid. That might be the language of Mr. Bush or Mr. Who you want, but it is not the reality. First of all, Islamism does not come from Islam world. It comes partly from Islam world, but partly from our world. The discovery I did with Omar Sheikh is that Omar Sheikh was among us, comes from our countries, comes from our intellectual landscape. He was shaped by the best English school, the London School of Economics. He was grown in the best London. He is a Westerner. He is a Westerner. So the Islamic terrorism comes from Western world as much as from Islamic world. It comes, to be precise, to be accurate, from the very intersection, from the very crossing of the two worlds. It is not a foreign phenomenon. It looks at us with the strangeness of a mirror, you know, a mirror. It is a mirror of ourselves. A mirror of ourselves.
But
it is not the daily mirror, but it is a sort of daily mirror of ourselves.
Why? Why did it take this hostile turn and try to destroy at least its half-parent?
Why what? I'm sorry, I did not get the point.
Why this destructive turn? Why did this this production of the West then take on the West as its mortal enemy?
There are a lot of reasons. This is the very purpose of the book, to try to explain this. I cannot explain in a few words. It is the purpose of the book. The book is on Daniel Pearl, of course, which I praise and which I find to be such a hero and such a great man. But it is also a book on Omar Sheikh. Omar Sheikh is, in a way, not the main, but one of the two characters of the book, and the longest travel I did was not to Dubai, was not to Kabul, was not to Karachi, was inside the mind of this very close man who is Omar Sheikh, close and far. My longest travel, my longest trip was to go inside of his soul. So I cannot sum up that in a few words.
I'm speaking with Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is the author of Who Killed Danny Pearl, just published in the United States by Melville House Publishing. Do you think that the Islamic world does have any argument with the United States and Israel for having supported some really, truly wretched governments over the years, and for now Israel treating its Palestinian population with considerable hostility? Is there some justice to at least some part of the cause?
Wait a minute. First thing, I think that there is never justice for terrorism. There is never a justification for killing civilians. You can have justification for war. You can have justification when you kill soldiers or men with weapons. You have never justification to kill civilians, innocent civilians. This is the first point. Second point, one of the results of my investigation, was of my conclusion, is that even if Israel did not exist, even if the Palestinian problem was solved, even if you had peace in the between Israeli and Palestinian, it would not change one inch, anything in the situation of the terrorism.
How do you know that?
How do I know that? Because I know what is today, after this year of work, I know what is the psychology of this man. I know that they don't care a damn about the Palestinian problem. Osama bin Laden, before the Twin Towers attack, never spoke about the Palestinian problem. He did not care about that. He spoke about the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia. For instance, he spoke about the corruption of the Arab regimes, but he did not speak about Palestinian problems. He spoke of that after the attack of the towers, not before. And as for the Pakistanis, as for the Karachi groups, Lashkar-e-Toiba and others, and Jaish-e-Mohammed, I know their text. I went through their literatures during long months. Their Palestine is named Kashmir. Kashmir for them is much more important than Palestine. They don't care. They never saw a Jew in their life. They have no contact with Israel. Israel for them is just like a sort of abstract name. It is not the point. You can have the peace in Israel. You will have as many members as Lashkar-e-Toiba. Daniel Pearl would have been killed the same way. This we must be very clear on that. It does not mean that we don't have to make peace in Israel, of course, and in Palestine. I am an advocate. I plead since 30 years in favor of a Palestinian state. I think that Israel and Palestinian people must make the peace and so on, of course. But let's be very clear on that. It will not change anything on the situation of the jihadism today and of the situation of the jihadism in this part of the world, this Asiatic part of the world.
What was the contribution, do you think, of the U.S. support for what became the jihadists in the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan?
A big contribution, and I saw that from my eyes at this time. You know, I am I'm rather familiar to this part of the world. I went to Pakistan and to Afghanistan for the first time in 1981, to bring some free radios to Commandant Massoud, the future anti-Taliban leader. So I know this area since a long time. And I saw with my eyes at the beginning of the 80s, of course, how the West and especially the American bred and fed and made grow these Islamist and fundamentalist forces. Because for a simple reason, they thought, and I met some people at this time in Peshawar in 91-92. I met some American people, I would not quote them now, this is too late and too far, but saying, wait a minute, we have one enemy, which is the Russia, which is the Soviet Union, which is communism. Against this enemy, all the weapons are all right. We take all sort of allies. We shall not be difficult at our allies. We take what comes. And that is the origin of this golem which they built, which is a fundamentalism, which they contributed to build. They did not build it completely, of course, but they contributed to its building. So this is a past. It is not a reason, of course, to be masochist and to say we built that and we deserve it. We built, now we have to fight, and we have to condemn, and we have to look at the future and to fight these people who hate not only the Western world, but also the Muslim world, itself. Their true enemy before the West is the moderate Muslims.
And how should this fight be undertaken?
How this fight will be undertaken? Well, by supporting the moderates, which we did not do since such a long time, and which we still do not do. We should have supported. I was close to Commandant Massoud, and I was so sad. I nearly cried when I saw Commandant Massoud wanting to go out of his country for the first time 3 months before his death, coming to Europe, and the doors being shut in front of him, Mr. Chirac, President of France, refusing to receive him, Mr. Jospin, our Prime Minister, receiving so rude, in such a rude way to receive him. We chose the Taliban against Massoud. And today, same, we receive Musharraf. We choose Musharraf against the Pakistani Democrats. Do you know in America what I tell in my book, that there is another Pakistan? Do you know? Do the public in America, do the average Republican elector, Republican militant, know that there is another Pakistan than the Musharraf Pakistan? Democrats, liberals, women, and women who refuse the law of the revenge and of the murder and of the veil, we do not know that. And this is a big mistake. To fight fundamentalism would mean to give our hands, tendre la main, to give our hand to this other Pakistan and to this other Muslim world.
Why do you think that Western politicians, particularly our own here in the United States, are so blind to this reality?
Again, it's difficult to respond in a few words. It is a big part of my book, which is not only an investigation, but also a book of reflection, of philosophy. What I think is that we are prisoners in America and in Western world in general of a stupid thesis, which comes from a few years, and which is the thesis, the ideology of the clash of civilization. We are convinced that there is a clash of civilization going on between the West and the rest. And this, I demonstrate in my book that this is stupid.
Finally, you opposed the war on Iraq. Why was that, and what do you think of the outcome so far?
I opposed the war of Iraq because it was a mistaken target, because it was a false target, because it was against a lie. Irresponsibility and lie. Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair lied to us. They knew it was not true. They knew that Al-Qaeda was not in Baghdad. They knew that Al-Qaeda, there was no massive destruction weapons. And what is the effect of such a lie? What is the effect? A lie of this sort prevents us to see where is the real danger, where is the real threat. And that is the reason why I was so against this war. We made an alliance with Pakistan, where you had really the weapons and the jihadism and so on, and we made a war against the Iraq, which was led by a dictator, of course, but dictator of old age, a sort of ghost, a sort of phantom of the past. It's like this mistake was like a bad dream, like a nightmare. You know, when you go, you have some films like this in the good American tradition of good movies, where you go to the police to protect yourself, and you don't realize that you are going exactly to the bad people who are going to kill you. We did the same with Pakistan. We shook hands with Pakistan, unknowing that the real danger is here.
And that was Bernard-Henri Lévy, author of the book Who Killed Daniel Pearl, just published by Melville House Publishing, and interview I recorded with him a couple of weeks ago. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Don't forget those two events, me and the Baffler Gang at Book Court, 163 Court Street in Brooklyn, tonight at 7, and also at 7, Tracy Kwan, whose novel, A Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, includes an appearance on this radio show. She will be at the Museum of Sex, 233 Fifth Avenue, the corner of 27th Street, also 7 p.m. in Manhattan. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week with a fundraising special along with Hugh Hamilton about my book, After the New Economy, and related matters. Till next week, let's go out with this from Fisher Spooner. Goodbye.
From nothing, you don't need to set up with.